Hello, survivalists. This is Crux True Survival Stories. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh. I'm joined by Julie Henningsen, and today Julie is going to be leading the story for us. What you got cooked up for us today, Julie?
Well, Casey, this is going to be episode one of an amazing survival story. Picture this. It's October 1942, the height of World War II. Renowned fighter pilot and war hero Eddie Rickenbacker finds himself not in the cockpit of a fighter plane, but stranded in the vast, unforgiving expanse of the Pacific Ocean. What began as a routine mission quickly spiraled into a desperate fight for survival.
Eddie, what was his last name?
Eddie Rickenbacker.
Rickenbacker, that is a last name right there.
It is, yeah. And he actually, it was Rickenbacker, B-A-C-H-E-R, but he changed it to Rickenbacker, B-A-C-K-E-R, around the time of World War II, or maybe before then, so that I think he's maybe Swiss or someplace non-German, but he didn't want his name to sound as German as it did during that period of history.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, so Eddie Rickenbacker, many people will recognize his name. I didn't before I researched his story, but it's, again, one of these stories that I'm like, how did I go my whole life without knowing this? It's pretty incredible. He was known as a fighter pilot ace in World War I. That was his original claim to fame. In fact, he was known as the Ace of Aces. He had all kinds of fame and popularity because of some of his victories in the cockpit of airplanes in World War I. But this is the story of him facing an enemy far more relentless than what anything he had previously encountered in the skies, the ocean itself. So a teaser for our story today, along with his flight crew, he drifted for weeks with no food, no water, no hope of rescue in sight on the Pacific Ocean. How did they survive? What kept them going when all seemed lost? I'll answer those questions today.
The thought of steak upon his rescue.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. The thought of, actually it was the thought of fruit juice, cold, refreshing fruit juice.
That is hilarious. I remember one time I was backpacking and we didn't have enough water and we were going up this big pass and I was fantasizing about Gatorade. I was just like, if I could have anything in the world right now, it would be a cold Gatorade. So granted, I mean, it wasn't like I was stranded without water for days, but I can understand where he's coming from.
Yeah, when you're really thirsty, you can relate to that feeling. Like, what body part would you exchange for a tall glass of cold water?
Oh my gosh.
That becomes like a reasonable question when you're as thirsty as some of our survivors have.
Could
been.
We just shave our heads? I mean, that seems like an appendage.
That would be a no-brainer. Yeah, that would be easy. Easy.
Yeah, also help cool you off.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so this is one of the most perilous survival stories that I've encountered of the 20th century. And it's a pretty well-known story, maybe for generations before us. To better share the story, let's begin with a little understanding about who Eddie Rickenbacker was. So Eddie Rickenbacker, as I said, an American fighter pilot ace in World War I. He was also a Medal of Honor recipient. And he just achieved a long list of pretty remarkable feats throughout his life, not only as an aviator, but as a military leader, a businessman, even a race car driver. So Eddie was born in 1890 in Columbus, Ohio, to a working class family. He was the third of eight children, and sounds like he was kind of a little hellion as a child. He led a little street gang of friends that called themselves the Horsehead Gang. He picked up smoking around the age of five.
What?
So they did things a little differently back in the 1890s. But yeah, he was a fiery little guy.
Yeah, by the time you're three, you're just completely independent out there on the street. No one cares where you are or what you're doing. There's no way to communicate. They're like, well, we have eight kids. If we lose one, meh, it's fine. We still have seven more.
Picking up your cigarette habit.
Crazy. How did he earn the money for cigarettes at five? That's what I want to know.
Well, I don't know how he did it at age five, but he dropped out of school at age 13 and went to work his dad actually died when he was 13. And because he was kind of an older kid in the brood of eight, he felt like it was his job to kind of start making some money to help his mom out. So the day after his father died, he dropped out of school and went to work. And he worked a lot of different odd jobs in his little Columbus, Ohio setting, including a lot of automobile companies. He got introduced to cars and kind of developed a love and interest in automobiles and racing.
That's cool.
Yeah. And over time, he became a race car driver. He started as a relief driver in the first ever Indianapolis 500. And then kind of became a pretty well-known race car driver between about 1912 and 1916. So he would have been in his early 20s. So before World War I started, he competed at the Indianapolis 500 four times.
And wow.
The best he ever did was in 1914. He placed 10th. So not bad, not too shabby, Eddie.
I wonder how his mom felt about that.
I think he gave his mom some gray hairs. This is just the beginning of his pretty epic adventures that any mother would not be okay with.
Yeah, the only thing that she had going for her is that there was no social media. So she didn't have to know about all of the shenanigans he was up to and then have more gray hairs.
Right. She might have been pretty oblivious to this. So during his driving days, he also kind of worked as a test driver and engineer, and a lot of his work ended up contributing to or influencing automobile design kind of really early on in the days of the automobile. And on one trip somewhere, he had an opportunity to ride in a small plane, which was pretty unique and unusual at that time. And that sparked an immediate interest for him in aviation. In fact, he kind of lost interest in automobiles and race car driving and was all about aviation after that point. So when World War I started, he just desperately wanted to be a fighter pilot. And that's what he set out to do, but he was denied. He was too old. He was 27 at the time, which in the scheme of things then and with flying kind of ruled him out. He also had bad vision. So there were a couple of reasons why he just couldn't follow that passion.
Yeah, back when the age 27 was like considered sort of old.
Yeah.
You lived to be like 47. That's your whole lifespan.
You're definitely middle-aged at that point.
Right.
Weird. Future's grim at that age, downhill from there.
Pretty much.
He ended up enlisting in the U.S. Infantry in 1917. This was, again, age 27. And he enlisted as a driver, which was obviously perfect for him. So his job was to drive important military officials around in Europe, mostly kind of like a chauffeur. And one of the higher ups that he was charged with driving got to know him and got to like him. He's a pretty charismatic guy and learned of his interest in aviation. So he was well connected. This official gave him an opportunity to learn to fly kind of in his free time in France, which he took up. So he did get in the cockpit and learned all the skills, got his pilot's license, and ultimately through that kind of backdoor route ended up joining a World War I flying squadron. And that was it. This is where our backstory gets started. He was an amazing pilot. He was fearless and skilled, very cool under pressure. And he survived multiple plane crashes and even more near misses. And, you know, all of the stories of his epics and antics were getting communicated back on the home front. So he just became this like
war hero.
War hero. Yeah. Just everyone knew his name. I mean, sounds like if you're going to name like the top five most famous people, he was probably on that list. And ultimately at the end of the day, he had the most kills, which I guess is a thing that they really held in high regard in World War I of any of the fighter pilots, 26. So that's how he earned the nickname of the Ace of Aces. And here's something interesting, kind of on a side note, that I came across in my research is that during this time, the military would not put parachutes in planes because they didn't want the pilots to like bail too soon. They didn't want to give them an out and then let their plane just wreck.
That's crazy.
So it was controversial. There were a lot of people that saw the flaw in that logic and fought for parachutes. But anyway, in his day, he didn't have the option to pull the eject button and parachute away. which is, makes it even more amazing that he survived all these events.
The statistics of planes that went down at that time, the planes were so much heavier than they are now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was just some things about that too, how apparently these World War I planes were like bargain basement. There were like all kinds of structural flaws, like, you know, siding flying off, commonly like known manufacturing problems that they just accepted and went with.
Wow.
So after World War I, Eddie Rickenbacker came back home and he was just celebrated by the American people for all of his flying victories. He was a war hero. He signed a high-paying book deal. He was offered roles in films, which he actually turned down. And he just continued to maintain this passion for aviation. After World War I, he started Florida Airways, which was an airline, commercial airline. And that later grew and became known as Eastern Airlines. Eventually, he became the president of Eastern Airlines. He was the president of Eastern Airlines. He started it. And he transformed it into one of the most profitable airlines in the U.S. at that time. So he was a really good, savvy businessman as well.
He's just one of those people that's literally good at everything.
Exactly.
It just makes you want to roll your eyes. Like, please, why do you have all of the skills? It's not fair.
He's good at everything. He's a risk taker. He's just like brazen. Not a lot of people really liked him. A lot of information about how people that worked with him, for example, like his employees at Eastern Airlines, he was like a hard ass and, you know, really hard to work for. And, you know, a lot of people thought he was uneducated, and he was. I mean, he dropped out of school at 13. So kind of hot and cold on his interpersonal relationships, but just super successful at all these pretty amazing endeavors.
It's like the high-performing surgeon that doesn't know how to have a conversation with a patient.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, I was recently having a conversation with somebody and I said, I want my surgeon to be the most awkward person in the room in a social setting.
I think you said that to me.
Okay. That could be like that to me, just having experience in the medical field means they're probably a pretty good surgeon, because very few people are, you know, good at the whole spectrum of human skills. So
right, that's true. Except for you.
Well, and you.
Of course.
So we're up to 1941, and this is where our first kind of mini survival story within the bigger survival story occurs. So president of Eastern Airlines, he was a passenger on Eastern Airlines Flight 21 aboard a Douglas DC-3 airliner from New York City to Atlanta, Georgia. And there was only like 13 people on the plane. And the pilot was really nervous. He'd only flown for Eastern Airlines for like a year or two and kind of a newbie on the scene. And he was flying Eddie Rickenbacker and the president of the company and all these important people. So he just didn't want to mess up.
I know that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. It might have played a role in the events that unfolded. But yeah, super, super normal human feeling to have when you're on the job of any kind. So they're coming into Atlanta at night and there's poor visibility on the landing, and the pilot's in communication with air traffic control, who is giving them advice and kind of said like, well, one plane that was about to land diverted and are headed somewhere else, but another plane just successfully landed. Just sort of a lot of ambiguity about whether or not this was a safe choice to proceed with landing, but ultimately that was what the pilot decided to do. And with the really poor visibility, there was also a miscalculation on the pilot's part in regards to their altitude. When they came out below the cloud layer, they just came in way lower than they thought they were and ended up crashing into some trees and some really hilly areas near Atlanta before the airport runway. And it was a pretty tragic plane crash. The pilots both died. Several other passengers did not survive. But five people survived the crash, including Eddie Rickenbacker. He was pinned under some portion of the plane that had been just completely annihilated, ripped apart. And it was a miraculous survival, that the fact that he didn't die. He was soaked in fuel, trapped in this wreckage. The press had mistakenly announced his death just because it was unbelievable that anyone could have survived this.
That just made him I was going to say that made him more popular, probably.
Yeah, it made him more popular. It made, like, created even more mystique around his life. His injuries were so severe that the emergency surgeons and physicians kind of left him for dead at some time when they got to the hospital because, you know, their focus was on taking care of the live ones, the people that have the best chance of survival or the ones that are going to benefit most. So they just sort of left him in the hallway for a while until they realized, wow, this guy's not dying.
Or they realized actually who he was. They probably didn't know he was. I hate to say it, but there's probably differences in treatment if you're a celebrity or a known person versus if you're just, you know, an average Joe.
Right. Yeah. And I probably didn't know who he was because one of his injuries was that his left eyeball had fallen out of the eye socket and was hanging down on his cheek. It was hanging on his cheek. And he was talking to people. He was like encouraging others to hold on, like words of inspiration.
Could he still see out of that eye?
I think he could just see out of his other eye, I'm assuming. But
I can't imagine. If that happened to me, I would be full on freaking out. Probably most people would be.
He had a fractured skull, a shattered left elbow with a crushed nerve, paralyzed left hand, broken ribs, a crushed hip socket, a broken pelvis, broken in two places, severed nerve at his left hip, broken left knee, and his left eyeball was out of the socket.
That is terrible. The worst thing, I think, is the eyeball. I just don't know how you could wait around for someone to put that back.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And when they did put it back, I'm getting ahead, but the doctor popped it back in without any kind of anesthesia because they didn't want to damage the optic nerve. There's some reasons why this just had to be done old school. So they just kind of grit your teeth, bite on this leather belt, and they popped his eyeball back in.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, especially now, it's like he would be headed right for CAT scan.
Yeah, he was coming in and out of consciousness. He wasn't conscious throughout the whole ordeal, but he had to be carried out of a ravine by search and rescue, you know, workers on a litter, and just this really treacherous survival story.
So what was that for plane crashes for good old Eddie? How many?
Well, that was his first commercial crash. All of his other crashes had been in World War One. So,
right. I was just wondering, what was the number?
Who knows? I don't know if we're, I don't think we're into double digits yet, but I'm not sure. Okay. So Eddie lives and he's ready to keep going. He spent 4 months in the hospital recovering and had some surgical stuff and all kinds of stuff. But after 4 months, he's still in Atlanta. He lives up in New York or in that area. So he's headed home after 4 months, using a cane, legs are two different lengths. You know, he's getting to be an older guy at this point. And really, his body has seen better days.
Could he see out of both eyes after all of this happened? Did he find out? Because that's really all I can focus on right now, Julie.
Yeah, that's a good question. I might have to get back to you on that. I want to say yes, because it was never suggested that he couldn't, but that's a good question. So now that this brings us up to World War II. He's too old and broken down to really do a lot of combat or get back in the cockpit. But because of his popularity and his fame and his, you know, notoriety to some extent, he was commissioned by government officials in World War II to promote war efforts, to join the PR campaign and travel around and talk to people about what high quality planes the U.S. Air Force has and just really pump up morale, which was a really important part of World War II. So he's well connected with, you know, high up government officials, Secretary of War. And as part of his travels to promote the war effort, he was entrusted with one of only three copies of secret plans that detailed the U.S. military plans to invade North Africa during World War II. And he was sent to meet and deliver these plans to General Douglas MacArthur. Yeah.
You know, what's really crazy is, not to give too much away, but I also have a story from World War II that is perfect right after this, because we go into details about a little bit about what happened in Africa. So.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I'm excited to hear that because I have to be honest, I was like, oh, we invaded North Africa.
Me too.
Yeah. I guess it was kind of an instrumental thing. I mean, you'll know more, you'll share more, but yeah, it sounded like it was sort of a big deal in the scheme of things. So then that made me think like, oh, one of three copies. That's right. There's no computers or copy machines, or these are probably like hand-drawn copies that somebody spent hours putting together.
Why did they feel like he was important enough to get this third copy of this thing?
Well, I think it had more to do with his, like, he was on the road, on the planes, traveling around. And it was like, hey, let's feed two birds with one scone here and have him meet up with General MacArthur, who is in, like, New Guinea or, you know, I can't remember if it was Brisbane, Australia, but someplace far, far away. So old Eddie's going there anyway. Let's give him the plans. He's a trustworthy guy.
I mean, we know his face, so therefore we should be able to trust him, obviously.
Exactly. And it's possible that he can't even really see the plans because we know his eyeball at one point was not in the socket. Oh. So vision might be questionable.
Well, I guess that way he can't spread things, you know.
Exactly. Possibly. And he was trustworthy. I mean, he was like a golden boy for the U.S. military. So he's got the plans in hand. The plan was to fly from California to Hawaii to an island in the really kind of remote part of the Pacific called Canton Island. They're going to refuel on Canton Island and then make their way to Brisbane, Australia for this meetup. And this really is where our most amazing chapter of the survival story begins. So tune in next week to hear
cliffhanger.
What happens with Eddie and the rest of his crew. So you're not going to want to miss what happens next. There's as unbelievable as Eddie's life has been up to this point, this next chapter is even more remarkable.
Were you wondering why this hasn't been made into a movie yet? Because whenever I hear stories like this, I'm like, this should be a movie.
Yes. And then I think, it probably has been made into a movie. And I just
in the 50s.
Seen it. Yeah,
it could be redone.
It could be redone. It has been made into multiple different books, including one called Lost at Sea, which is sort of recently published by John Wukowitz. A really good book. I recommend that one. Yeah. And that's your spoiler alert or your cliffhanger. The name of the book is Lost at Sea. We haven't been lost at sea yet with Eddie. So hint,
foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing. That's what comes next. Before we wrap up with this episode, we'd like to ask for your support in spreading the word about the Crux True Survival Stories. Join us next week, and if you enjoyed today's episode, take a moment to visit our Instagram page at the Crux Podcast. And we encourage you to share our latest posts on your stories. Help us reach more fellow survival enthusiasts and storytellers. If you haven't already, please leave a rating and a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback means a lot to us, and it helps us continue bringing you compelling survival stories. Also, if you have a survival story that you'd like to share with us or topics you'd like us to explore, we'd love to hear from you. Write us at thecruxsurvival@gmail.com. Thanks for your support.
And just so you guys know, I'm going to start putting our email and our Instagram in the description. So if you can't remember it, you can just find it there. So reach out to us with anything.
Have a fantastic week and join us next week to hear more about Eddie Rickenbacker.
Can't wait. See you later, Julie.
See ya.